My name is Mark Massion. It's Saturday, October 24th, 1981. I'm at the home of Mr. Alfred Lohman. Mr. Lohman is the only son of Al Lohman, one of the original gnome Lohmans, who were active in the development of the reindeer and shipping industries. They were also prominent in promoting early aviational efforts in Alaska. Mr. Lohman has agreed to spend some time with me today and share some of his memories and observations of growing up in Alaska.
Yes, I'm Alfred Lohman. I was born in Nome, Alaska, on September 5th, 1918. The Lohman family started in Nome in 1900 with the arrival of my grandfather Lohman and my uncle Carl, who was the oldest of the five Lohman boys. My mother's father, Thorpe Lehman, arrived in Alaska during the summer of 1898 by a sailing ship at St. Michael, whence his group was trying to reach Dawson. They froze in at Russian Mission a few hundred miles up the Yukon, and upon hearing about the gold strike in Nome the following spring, he and his partner took off for Nome. How many years he mined, I'm not positive, but he did go in the grocery business, which he continued until he sold out and retired in 1944.
Mr. Lohman, do you know if you ever made any money mining?
As far as I am concerned, the entire history of the Lohman and Lehman family is one of investing small quantities and possibly even larger quantities of money in mining with a probably total lack of return. I could tell, we're digressing quite early here in the game, but I can tell a little story about that.
Sure.
My grandfather Lehman patented 1,500 acres of mining property over near Nome, which cost at that time, I don't know, 50 cents, probably a couple dollars an acre, I presume, at least, which was good sized money in 1925 and 26.
Was this close to Nome? Or
close to Nome, it's only about 6 miles from town.
Uh-huh.
That passed into my mother's hands, and eventually she deeded it to me with an understanding that my four sisters would also participate in any revenue. A few years ago, I got a call from a contractor in Nome desiring some rock. And I said, gee whiz, there's no rock on that valley, on that property. Well, just to jump ahead, a few years before that, the highway department had come to me and wanted a right-of-way across the property. And I said, fine, and 10 miles of the highway, that's great. So we sat down and signed it up, and in a short time, I got a $1,500 check for the purchase of the right-of-way. Well, that was first profit off the property, and of course, 100% profit because there was no expense. A few years later, I got a call from a contractor who wanted some rock. I said, fine, have at it if there's any rock on the property. He said, yes, when they built the highway, they ran through some little ledge of rock. So out of that, we, over a two-year period, we collected another $4,000 or $5,000. Again, 100% profit. So for a few years, I used to brag that I had probably the most profitable gold mine in Alaska on a percentage of profit basis.
Mr. Lohman. You know, lots of people came to Alaska to try their luck at mining, and I'm not so sure that many of them ever really made it. In your experiences, how many people did you actually know of who made a living at mining, who actually made enough money to say they were successful?
Well, just an opinion, but of the thousands of people that came to, say, Nome in the Gold Rush days, and up through at least into the 30s, I would say that, again, just a personal opinion, there was very few that made what you would call a success of mining. And to pick a percentage, I would be as pessimistic as to say possibly 1 in 100, and I may even be stretching the point at that. And I make a very broad statement, which I make quite often, that probably there has been more money invested in mining than has ever been realized from the mines.
What happened to the miners who were just broke and out on their luck? Where did they go? How did they get grub-staked again?
Well, over there, from stories I've heard and from knowing a few, there was always, if you made a little money, you would say, during the course of the summer, you'd take the last boat to Seattle. Possibly be discouraged, so just wouldn't come back. If you were down on your luck, usually there would be some odd jobs. One of the main odd jobs over there was what they called longshoring. In other words, when the ship came in, you'd go down and handle cargo at $1 an hour to make enough money to buy a ticket to get out of Seattle. And then, of course, there was the, you could go to see the federal judge, and he had in his possession what they called a blue ticket, which he could give you, and that would provide steerage accommodations to Seattle to permit you to get out of the country. That blue ticket was also used as a means of law enforcement, that the judge could force you to take a blue ticket so that you would leave the territory and not become a burden upon society, particularly with our long winters, get rid of you.
Talking about long winters, did established society in Nome, did they sort of frown on miners staying over for the winter? Did they not want that element in town?
Oh, no. I'm just talking of, say, the marginal, the one that would become a drain upon society. Good person or the common person, there was no feeling, there would be no feeling one way or another. But if you put a fellow in jail in October and have to feed him all winter, it'd be much easier to give him a blue ticket and get rid of him and pawn him off on someone else than to have him around in locked up community such as Nome was, where there would be no communication, literally no communication from October until the following June.
What kind of, talking about being locked up for the winter, is there any special memories you had as a child of events that were always highlighted during the winter, or things that come to mind, special times?
Well, of course, when I grew up, the town was, I'm talking now of the 20s, the town was on a pretty low, quite a low ebb. We had the gold rush at the turn of the century when there was 25,000 to 50,000 people there. They built clubs, they built large halls. In fact, there was one that was large enough to have a full-sized indoor baseball game in.
Oh, what hall was that? Do you remember that?
The Eagles Hall. I don't remember the dimensions, but it was quite an elaborate place with two balconies, one above the other, and so that the full floor, and you could have athletic events, you could have social events. They had a big stage with a professional curtain in front of it, as I can remember, for professional or amateur theatricals. So that in those early days, it was quite a place. But as the easy mining disappeared, of course, people left, and population was probably down in the close to 2,000 in mid-20s. So that those facilities just weren't affordable by the people were still there.
Well, who owned them at that time then?
Well, the Eagles Hall was owned by the Fraternal Order of Eagles, and they were still had a few, probably still had a few active members. And just as a little interesting sidelight, the Eagles Hall was used occasionally, and originally when it was built, it had a big boiler and was completely steam heated, but of course 2,000 people can't afford to pay the heat bill to keep that heated, so they took put in some coal stoves, big old pot belly. As I remember, they put one in each corner of the building. And in the wintertime, if they had something that justified the use, the caretaker would go in about 3 days before, fire up each one of these stoves, get them red, and I do mean glowing on the outside, keep them that way for about 3 days, and come the day or the night of the fair, the hall was passably warm. So that we did have indoor baseball, we had some basketball, and then an occasional amateur theatrical, and there would be a few, which I didn't attend, but my parents would attend a few dances and such social affairs, so that the winters were broken up with activity, and also the home use of home entertainment, dinner parties, bridge games, charades, activities such as that gave a fairly nice social activity. It wasn't completely dead.
It was fairly tight-knit then.
But it was a tight-knit uh-huh. community, and my family entertained somewhat. We had pridefully owned two round tabletops. So mother was going to entertain, I think one tabletop would seat 12, one tabletop would seat 16. So if she was going to have somewhere under 12 people for dinner, we would roll this tabletop in and set it on the top of our regular dining room table, and we're all set. Or she could have as many as 16 if we rolled a big tabletop.
Mm-hmm. I believe your parents are almost famous in a minor way for entertaining the explorers.
Oh, they understand. They through the years, been fairly active in the community and quite outgoing. Entertained almost literally anybody of any importance and some not so important that did come through, come into Nome.
Do you remember any of them?
Oh, I can remember one, probably the most famous one that I just sat at the same table with was Lindbergh and his wife when they came through Nome, I think it was 1932, on trip to for pioneering Pan American Airways proposed air service between the United States and the Orient. They came into Nome on their in their plane, which was on floats, and spent a couple of days there. We did.
Do you remember what kind
we
of
did, we did have it was oh I don't know, specially built I think.
The twin engine Mostar?
No, it was just a single, as I remember. A single. I don't recall that. They spent a couple of days in town. We did have the dinner. One of their real good friends, and through the years, was Roald Amundsen, Norwegian explorer. I don't remember myself being in his company at affairs, but I do know that he spent a considerable time in Nome. It was very, very close to the family. Mentioning Amundsen, one of my early recollections. I'm not positive of the year, but let's say it was 1923 or before. Amundsen came into Nome on the Maud after having completed a 2-year trip through the Northeast Passage, in other words, from the Atlantic to the Pacific over northern Russia. And I believe that was the first such trip, which meant that he was the, I think I'm right on this, that he was the first man to go through both the Northwest and the Northeast passages. He had, as history tells you, gone through the Northwest Passage on the Yoa and came into Nome about 1909, I think it was, after having spent 2 or 3, 4 years on that trip. And at that time, made the acquaintance of our family. And I'm not sure at that time whether he was such, but later my grandfather was the Norwegian consul. That may not be the exact title, but anyway, he was the go-between Norwegian government and the town of Nome. So we met Amundsen, but to continue with the Maud, as I remember, quite a beautiful, in my young eyes, beautiful ship, tall masted, white, laying offshore in Nome. And apparently the trip took less time than they had originally planned. So Amundsen had considerable supplies left over, which he sold to the Lohmann brothers for eventual resale in their drugstore. I can remember that they had some nice wheat crackers, similar to wheat thins or something that we might have now, probably quite nourishing, that were packed in wooden boxes, and inside the wooden boxes were sealed up, soldered up metal containers so that these crackers would be just as fresh after 5 years of storage as they were the day they were prepared. One of the other products which we particularly appreciated was a canned whipping cream. Having no cows in the home and only having condensed milk, we particularly appreciated this delicacy. Quite a supply of it that lasted for 2 or 3 years, and as the supply dwindled, people would guard it with their life because it was such a delicacy. As the supply ran down, they made an attempt to locate a replacement product, but as I understand it, the Federal Food and Drug, or whoever was in charge at that time, would not let the product be imported from Norway or Denmark. So when it ran out, we lost a very nice treat.
Almost it must have had the delicate taste there, but had that much whipped cream on it.
Well, it was probably also, probably very nourishing. In fact, they may have had it for the milk and the nourishment, where we in Nome just liked the richness and the whipped cream rather than just having canned cream.
Uh-huh. What did you have in Nome when you were growing up that supplanted these things? What did you eat as kids that if you didn't have ice cream and you didn't have chocolate, perhaps?
Oh, we had everything that everybody had anyplace else.
Came in from Seattle?
Came in from Seattle, of course. In the wintertime, everything came out of a can. Your canned vegetables, your canned fruit. In the summer, we would get, each boat would bring in some fresh things. Normally, we would have bananas, grapes, whatever. Nome being on the coast and being cold, the raising of fresh things there during the summer, you could raise a little lettuce if you really worked at it, but really wasn't very successful. So even lettuce was imported from Seattle. My mother, fall of the year, if she knew she was going to be entertaining sometime in the reasonable future, buy her lettuce and then protect it and nurse it along and keep it as long as she could, and then if the guests didn't eat the lettuce, as I don't, when it came back out in the kitchen, she'd wash it off and keep it for the next time. That was a very acceptable occurrence there, because lettuce was expensive and, of course, was very, very scarce.
Hmm. Did the town folk make use of natural resources? Did people put up their own meat and fish?
No, I'd say no, because really we didn't have any to speak of. But the only game in that area at that time would be
1920s.
Yeah, it would be some ptarmigan in the fall, and there would be some ducks and geese in the spring. Of course, now it's illegal to hunt ducks and geese in the spring, but there's none there in the fall. They've already gone south. There really wasn't any, as you would think of other places in Alaska. Of course, there was the reindeer, which wasn't a game animal. It was actually owned by people, so people wouldn't have access to them other than by purchase.
Mm-hmm. Did your father and his family, did they sell reindeer? Was it the meat for sale during the winter?
They wouldn't, they didn't, weren't in the retail. But they and possibly the natives at home would sell through the stores, like my grandfather Lehman had a butcher shop, and he would have reindeer. Tony Collette with Collette store would have reindeer that they acquired, to say, from the Lomans or from other sources. On a commercial basis, and mentioned fish. There was some sport fishing up there, and some salmon fishing for dog food. But as I remember, there was no great amount of fish available either.
Hmm. Well, what did the natives do? Were they also dependent on stores or and, you know, food from Seattle?
Well, they would do a little. They would do some fishing, say, for dog food and for drying for dog food and possibly some for human consumption. They would do some sealing, catching the seals out on the ice. People living away from town, like the King Island natives and people of Wales, other places like that, would do quite a bit of, as I remember, would go for walrus and seals. But you remember that the reindeer were imported originally at the turn of the century to take up the lack of natural. And so far as I can remember, that carried on through my lifetime over there. I can remember in about 46s or 47s that the first moose drifted into the area, and I eventually had a moose steak from that animal. And now, as I understand, that is one of the better moose hunting areas of the state.
Hmm. Were the moose planted, or are they?
No, the moose had come back and drifted over from the interior, say. For some reason, because of vegetation, or some reason that I understand moose are quite prevalent now. But during my childhood, no, the only animal I would ever see is the occasional reindeer.
Mr. Lohman, getting back to those. long winter nights in Nome during the winter. What kind of communications did Nome have with the outside world? When did your mail come in?
Well, during the winter, and this during the winter, the mail would come by boat from Seattle. Originally, it would come in to probably Valdez, and then be taken by dog sled over the trail to Nome. In 1923, when the railroad was completed, the mail would go into Seward, go up the railroad, and at Nenana would be transferred to dog team, go down the Yukon River and across the Caltech Portage to Unalakleet and along the coast to Nome. So that every Friday afternoon, about 4 or 5 o'clock, the mail would be in Nome and eagerly awaited by the people in town. And it was amazing how dependable that service was. During one of the later mail carriers over there was a man by the name of Pete Hearn, who lived down in Solomon, which was about 30 miles east of Nome. And he had used a team of, I'm told, of approximately 32 dogs, and would make this run back and forth during the winter. Of course, that was only small mail, first class, and possibly some magazines.
How long did it take to get to Seattle?
You mean by, say, in the event that a person wanted to go to Seattle in the winter? No. Dog team trip to Railhead was about the only practical means. In 1920, Grandfather Lehman, for some reason, wanted to go outside, and he hired Leonard Sepla. If you remember, Leonard Sepla was one of the great dog racers of the area. Grandfather and Leonard Sepla made it from Nome to Fairbanks in 20 days. And talking with my grandfather about that, somebody made the comment that Sepla must have had a pretty fast team, because normally it would take about 30 days. And my grandfather said, no, it wasn't the fact that the team was so fast, it was just that I like to get up early in the morning. In about 1920, either 27 or spring, I think it was the spring of 1927, my father had to get to New York as fast as he could. He was faced with this 30-day trip to Railhead. And instead, he sent a message over to Fairbanks and hired Joe Crossan, who was a pilot in Fairbanks. And this was probably in March, to come over and pick him up and fly him to Fairbanks. It took Joe 2 days in an open cockpit airplane. Stayed overnight in Nome, and then the next day my father and Joe took off for Fairbanks. It was a 2-day trip back to Fairbanks. It cost my father $800 for the trip, where it probably would have cost him $1,000 by dog team. As he was preparing for this trip, he let the word out that he was taking it, and that if anybody had any letters that he would like to have them carry along, it would get to the States much faster than by the usual method. So he had a little sack of mail, and his excess baggage, because of the mail, as I remember, was $60. So he had to actually pay $860 for the trip.
This wasn't the first time people had known and seen a plane, was it?
Oh, no. This was the first trip. First trip, and probably the first airplane that was ever known in the winter.
When did the first summer
first
come in?
Noel Wien was in there, I think, in the summer of 1925 with his Fokker aircraft. I can remember going down and taking a look at it. It looked like a pretty harsh airplane. He had been chartered in Fairbanks to bring Norman Steins, who was one of the large plane people over there, and he partied in Nome, but they nosed over at Ruby, and the plane was delayed, and Norman Steins took the riverboat, and I can remember arriving at Nome, and then later Nome had his plane propeller repaired and continued on, and took them back to Fairbanks. And of course, the Black Wolf Squadron goes back into, went right after World War I.
I don't know anything about that.
This squadron flew up from New York and landed at, in, I think that was probably the first airplane.
Were they just touring or flying a.
They were on a cross country, the Black Wolf Squadron was on a cross country. Training mission, accomplishment, four of them, something like that. Came up cross country and I believe just went as far as Nome and then went back. And so airplanes were known over there.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember in, I think it's about 1924. Sailing ship came into Nome, and on it, or they brought up a jenny that they put together, and I can remember it flying around overhead a few times. What it was for or why, I don't know. Up, but I don't think we've ever put too many commercials. But that was probably the first airplane I'd ever seen.
Your father put planes to commercial use and that he used them to herd deer, didn't he? Or to scout out?
Well, he used them, yes. He used them for transportation to get to various points of commercial activity or the various reindeer herds, and at times would use them for supply purposes, hauling supplies into the reindeer herders, or in some instances even going out to try and locate where the deer were, or in the lighterage business, which we haven't mentioned on this tape, he would occasionally have to go out and look largest one. And father just loved flying an airplane. He would take an airplane trip just any time anybody had any faintest excuse or if somebody would invite him along. So as a consequence, he knew quite a few of the pilots. Very, very active interest in aviation. And I can remember just as a little side light, realized what money was, but I can remember when the airplane trip from Nome to Fairbanks came down from $550 to approximately $350. And my dad's opinion then that was the way to travel. That brought it into the realm of anybody that wanted to make a trip, the way they should go. And of course, you realize this is back in the 20s and 30s, $350 was lots and lots of money.
Money, really? I was just thinking when you're talking about the prices for the dog sled, $1,000. A long trip, that's an amazing amount of money.
Sure, it certainly is. And that's one thing we sometimes lose track of in this present day. As I mentioned, the father was very interested in aviation. Might also say that because of the friendship and the working with and helping of various explorers, Ralph, Carl, and my father were all members of the Explorers Club in New York, which of course he amplified their friendship and acquaintanceship with explorers and that type from all parts of the world. In the fall of 1929, the aviation company, which had been set up in Fairbanks in the spring of 29 by Ben Ileson, took a contract to ferry furs and some people from the trading ship Nanuk, which was stuck over on the north coast of Siberia. There was fear that the price of furs was dropping, and that the quicker these furs could be reach the market in New York, the better the economics of the trading would be. So he made, I believe, one successful trip and brought furs back to Nome. And on his second trip, disappeared. A search was instituted almost immediately, but this was in November with extremely bad weather and, of course, very short days. Joe Crossan and others were able to get to the Nanuk as a headquarters, but of course they had to be supplied with aviation gas from Nome. The Aviation Corporation of America, I believe, was their name. Later became American Airlines, owned this little company in Alaska. They hired my father to be their coordinator on the American side to organize planes, crews, to keep the fuel moving to the Nanuk, so that he was, they set up a their headquarters was more or less Teller, which was a jumping off spot. That was the closest place with facilities. And you have to remember that a lot of the planes were still open cockpit biplanes. Many instances would use, say, half the fuel that they could carry just in getting there. So it was a slow and dangerous process. Four Fairchild biplanes that had at that time to fold back, the wings could fold back, were shipped up by boat from the States to Fairbanks, and four pilots were hired in Canada who had had Arctic experience, were hired, plus the local people. The Russians, from the Russian side, sent over, I believe it was two planes to a assessed. And eventually, probably in February, I suppose, might have even been March, on the last flight over the area, the wing of the plane was found, and eventually the plane was, or wreckage was excavated by hand. All been drifted over with snow. The plane was scattered. The bodies were, the two bodies from the airplane were quite separated. One of the Russians